If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm your host, Ed Newcomer. And today, we have a really cool guest, a friend of mine for a long time. His name is Craig Spencer. Craig is the founder and director of the NGO called Transfrontier Africa, which is based at Olifants West Nature Reserve in South Africa. It's part of a larger coalition of private nature reserves making up the Greater Kruger Area, which borders and buffers Kruger National Park in South Africa. He also served as the head warden of Balule Reserve for many years, and he remains a warden of Olifants West. Craig is a unique character. He's been a champion of engaging local communities in taking an active role in managing the resources and environment that are important to them. Among his initiatives has been the formation of the Black Mambas, among many others that we're going to talk about today. But let me welcome Craig Spencer to the podcast. Craig, thanks for being here.
Absolute pleasure, Ed. Good to see you again.
Yeah, fantastic. We were just kind of reminiscing before we started recording and realized it's been a few years since we saw each other. Craig and I actually met while I was a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I was actually based in Southern Africa. My remit or my area of responsibility was basically, 9 countries in Southern Africa, including South Africa. So I was very in tune with what was going on in terms of elephant, rhino poaching, pangolin poaching out there in the Kruger area. And Craig and I met fairly early in my time there, and then we stayed in touch. Mm. But I do have to say, to get an idea, if you're from the U.S. and you haven't been to South Africa, Kruger National Park is huge. It's the size of the state of New Jersey, basically. But surrounding the park, at least primarily on the west side, the east side would be Mozambique. But on the west side, there are a number of private game reserves that kind of buffer the park, right? And Olifants West is one of those. And these are large reserves. And for the average American who's used to our national park system, these are private reserves that have, you know, lodges and tourist activities available. But they also have the usual gamut of big game wildlife living on those reserves. And in many cases, correct me if I'm wrong, Craig, there's actually the fences are down between the reserves and the park, right?
There's no fences in between.
Yeah. So wildlife, elephants, lions, leopards, rhinos can move freely between the park and some of these private reserves. So there's a very important shared interest between the reserves and the national park in terms of conserving wildlife and stopping wildlife trafficking. So anyway, first time I met Craig, he comes rumbling down the road in this unbelievably beat up Land Rover Backy, which again, for Americans, a Backy is a pickup truck, and jumps out. And here's this young guy with a charming accent, messed up hair, windblown hair, tanned skin. And the first thing he does, he pulls out a pipe.
Yeah. I'm not allowed to smoke it here, unfortunately. There's rules.
No, but right in front of us, he's got his little tobacco pouch with his pipe sticking out of it. And he grabs a puff wherever he can.
Yep.
But I got to tell you, Craig, when you're in the United States, you probably discovered this already. But where are you from originally? You're a Brit, right? Or you're South African?
My family is English.
Uh-huh.
And I was born in Botswana.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved down to South Africa.
Uh-huh.
I'm the last man standing there from our family. Everybody else has moved back overseas.
You are kind of the classic, like, cut from another era of, like, the British expat living in Africa. You got the whole package. And when you come here in the States, you have to know that if you speak with a British accent and you smoke a pipe and you talk about African wildlife, people are going to believe everything you say.
Oh, this is good to know. I thought you were going to say you'll get arrested.
No.
People, the other way around.
Everybody who's interested in wildlife in the States will instantly love you, just as I did. So anyway, you and I hit it off pretty quickly, and I really admire what you're doing there. So let's stop talking about me. Let's talk about you. Tell us a little bit about these private reserves. Like, how big is Olifants West, and what kind of animals do you have living there?
So, yeah, that's exactly like you said before. You know, the Kruger National Park is about 430 kilometers long from north to south. But at its widest point, it's only 60 kilometers, which is a short breeze for an elephant to walk, you know, right, through the night. And we have this hard public interface with the agricultural sector and the tribal villages and whatever, right on that western boundary. And that public interface, that's where you get all these human wildlife conflict issues, elephants breaking out, raiding crops, lions going out and eating cattle. So it was a good move to expand the park, to absorb a lot of those old agricultural holdings and include them into the park. So, you know, it was very easy as well. You take the fences down and the animals just come and occupy those landscapes. So, yeah, 20 years later, we have everything from, like you said, crocodiles in the rivers, hippos in every dam, elephants, lions, cheetahs from time to time, wild dogs, you know. It's a plethora of the most amazing, iconic species in Africa. The parks themselves, there's five basic units. That center cluster where we are, wow, how big is that? I mean, the part that I'm responsible for is about 25,000 acres. And then on the other side, so we've got two landscapes that we manage. And on the other side, it's similar. So you could say about 50,000 acres in total.
Okay.
So, and it works on the federal system because it's too big. You know, you can't have like a principality running the show there. You actually have to have a federal system broken into bite-sized chunks with a common management objective, common management plans, standard operational procedures, and cross-border protocols as well. You know, we're pursuing whether it's a wounded elephant that we have to dart to take a snare off its foot, or a rhino that's been shot, or a poacher that we're chasing. We have to have cross-border protocols to say we're moving into the next area. Can the next warden take over and the next warden and so on?
Interesting.
So on, yeah.
And you're talking about these that you're describing as federal. These areas are just different areas broken up within Olifants? Or are you talking about the neighboring?
Olifants would be one state.
Gotcha.
Basically, yeah.
And then the other private reserves would be the others.
Correct, yeah.
And then, of course, too, because there's no fence between you and Kruger National Park, you probably have to have operating protocols with Sand
For
Parks,
sure.
which operates the
That's
park,
right.
right?
They're kind of the big brother. They're the federal agency, if you wish.
Yeah, they're the government agency.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to talk about next is, you know, so because the wildlife moves back and forth and, you know, poaching has touched South Africa, all of Africa, but South Africa in particular with regard to rhinos and other species, you're in a tough spot because you're a private reserve. But you don't have government authority. There's no law enforcement authority given to the rangers at Olifants West or any of the other private reserves, correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge.
Yeah. But normally, these parks, these reserves do have, obviously, they have patrol rangers who are armed usually. Yeah.
Yep.
So it puts them in a tough spot, right? Because they're just like a private security guard.
Yeah.
And, that's right. You know, South African laws with regard to self-defense and things can be a little bit tricky. Sometimes, in my experience, South African police tends to show up and make arrests first before they make any inquiries about justifiable self-defense or anything like that, right?
Very true.
Yeah. So let's talk now, before we jump into forming the Black Mambas and what they are and why you formed them. Let's make sure everybody kind of understands what the conservation issues are facing all of Southern Africa, but Kruger and the private reserves, including Olifants West. You mentioned rhinos and elephants. So let's hear from you. I know what the situation is with rhinos. I think most of my listeners will know that it's an issue, but what's going on with rhinos and also elephants and other species in your area?
You know, Ed, if you think back to those times when it was critical, you know, pre-COVID, we could say.
Yeah.
And when I started as a warden, I've been 20 years on that landscape. Mm. I came from a government agency before, so it was really hard to adjust to the public sector, the private sector, where we no longer had any authority.
Yeah. Where'd you work before?
In the Western Cape.
Oh, okay.
Also in anti-poaching law enforcement. And So it was really, it was a tough adjustment to come into the private sector and suddenly find that you actually don't have any authority anymore to implement the legislations, and the rules of engagement don't even exist for you. So when we lost our first rhino, around about 2010, and it was a rude awakening for us. And we woke up one day and we discovered that our entire law enforcement capacity was a guy on a bicycle with a stick. You know, yeah, that was it. His name was Derek Amnisi. He rode around on this bicycle, very proud of himself, slept under every tree, you know, because there was actually nothing going on.
Right.
You know, we were managing the park as it was ecological management. So we were opening and closing water holes, improving grazing capacity, you know, attracting animals in, doing game counts, et cetera. The next thing, you know, we stumbled upon a rhino carcass. We realized that this thing's being poached. And when we started digging deeper, we recognized that we actually had more, you'll remember this from those days, we had more rhinos than we did elephants in the greater Kruger system in those days.
Right, right.
But the elephants were being poached at a rate of 96 a day for their ivory in sub-Sahara Africa.
Wow, I didn't know it was that high. Not just South Africa, but
the whole of sub-Sahara. Yeah,
yeah, okay.
And when they did the census in Mozambique, the great elephant census, 48% of the animals that they counted were carcasses.
Jeez.
The elephants, and that's... I could see it from the deck of my camp.
Mm.
And I thought, man, if this problem persists across this border, and, you know, eventually they're going to run out of elephants. So then they will come across the border to our neck of the woods. We had 222 days of elephants if at that rate of exploitation.
At that rate.
Yeah.
Okay.
So was it about rhinos, or was it about elephants, or was it about everything? You know, we can't focus on one thing. But the rhinos gave us this great opportunity. It was really hard to generate sympathy for an elephant because they just keep raiding crops, you know, squashing people on bicycles and, you know, stealing your water and, you know, damaging things.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's interesting because globally in the US, Canada, Western Europe, elephants are very charismatic, right?
Yeah.
But to people who have to live with elephants in Botswana,
pain in the
Zambia,
bloody neck. Yeah.
They can be a pain in the neck. They're really hard to stop. Yeah. If they want to destroy your crop, they will. And a lot of these people, you know, they're small farmers and they rely on those crops. So yeah, there's locally, there's not much sympathy for elephants.
No.
But interesting, was that different for rhinos?
It was.
Ah.
You know, suddenly the world went mental when the first rhino was shot. Mm. And, you know, it was all over social media. It was a global phenomenon, you know. And then we started waking up to the fact that we were losing more than we were counting. So, you know, eventually it got to the point where we were losing more than three in a 24-hour cycle. So it was nighttime poaching. Three rhinos every night were being poached. You know, three or more incursions a night onto the landscape. Mm. It was a terrible time of our lives. And this persisted for 10 years.
Yeah. And that, and you weren't alone. I mean, that was kind of the average. When I landed in Southern Africa in 2015, and right away, it was clear to me the average among the private reserves that had rhinos and Sand Parks, Kruger, they were losing three to four a day.
Yeah.
And that's not sustainable. Rhinos cannot they can't outbreed that.
Not a chance.
Yeah.
And you know, this is not the first time this has happened to rhinos.
Okay.
In my conservation career spanning 30 years, this is the third time that rhinos have almost been poached to extinction. So it comes in waves.
Interesting.
You know, when I started, we had Operation Bicornis Way back when the end of the 80s, the early 90s.
Mm.
You know, all the same debates, all the same issues, all the same... efforts made to dehorn and put bitumen on the stump so it's not attractive and la la la. And then it goes away. And that was when the Yemenis were selling the daggers with the handles as a rite of passage to adulthood, if you remember.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what was the drivers then? It was a different driver,
right?
It was
a different driver, yeah.
Fascinating. That to me is what's really fascinating because I've always talked about wildlife trafficking kind of going in waves or cycles. And, you know, law enforcement tamps it down and it goes away for a while and then it comes back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But what was so fascinating about rhinos is, the early drivers were, there was some use of it for Asian medicinal, but the real driver was, those Yemeni special daggers where the handle had to be carved out of rhino horn. And I remember that.
Yeah.
When I was in college, that was like all over the news.
We should never forget that.
Yeah.
And that entire culture, if you like, has shifted.
Yes.
You know, I think it was when oil was suddenly a big deal for the Yemeni's economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's probably yachts and Ferraris, you know, that are more important well, as a gift.
I think, too, there was kind of an awareness that they may be contributing to the demise of a species, right? That was my impression. I don't know if that's true.
I like to think so as well. And they became part of, but I do think oil was catalytic because they actually became part of the global community then as well, you know, and the norms and standards in their society probably went through a shift.
Interesting.
But you're absolutely right. They saw the writing on the wall. They didn't want to be responsible for the extinction of a species.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great. What a number of species, because there's many rhinos. I mean, look what happened in Java. How many rhinos are left there?
Exactly. In Vietnam. I think there's 50. There's zero in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They went extinct in my time as a conservationist.
2010 was the last Javan rhino in Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Scary stuff.
Yeah.
So this cycle, like you said, you've gone through several cycles, but this new cycle that emerged around 2010 to 2013-ish, what was the driver of that?
So the end user market, the consumer market is primarily in China, but then Vietnam became a new consumer.
Yep.
And it's not even a part of their traditional lifestyle, medicine, whatever it is, you know. But I think the smuggling route through Vietnam probably stimulated a market with the syndicates there because they've got that porous border with China.
Yep.
So, yeah, and now we sit with this, you know, not just one cultural traditional use that we have to try and get a handle on. We've now got this whole new market that's feeding the supply and demand chain.
Exactly. And I think most people get confused, or a lot of people get confused, and they still think of it in terms of its value as an aphrodisiac or medicinal.
Oh, yeah.
That ain't really it. It's a little bit, but the big thing now is it's a status symbol, right? And they'll carve it into these elaborate, what they call libation cups. Looks like a cup, but it's very intricately carved. Same with ivory. A lot of it is about status. It's carved into very almost, you know, pretty amazing pieces of art. But the reason you want it is not necessarily to consume it. It's to show the rest of the world how affluent you are.
It is.
Yeah.
It's like having the red Ferrari.
Yes. Yes, exactly. You show your neighbors how important you are by having them over to dinner, and they see a rhino horn libation cup on your mantle.
Right? You know, there's a interesting story. I know this is anecdotal.
Yeah, yeah.
But way back when, whether this is a true story or an urban legend or not, it's still worth telling. The first warden of the Kruger National Park, Stevenson Hamilton, I think his name was, and he had an audience with the royal family, and he was asked, is it true that rhino horn is an aphrodisiac?
Mm.
And he said, madam, the only way that it will work is if you cut it into strips and use it as a splint. And he's right.
And I suppose they're the right shape.
Yeah, but it's a great story. But it's a false story. You know, it's never been used as an aphrodisiac ever. Right. I don't know actually how that story started. Maybe just because it looks kind of phallic.
I don't know. And then it was kind of exacerbated in Vietnam, I think, because a government sometime around 2010-ish, a Vietnamese government official went public, claimed that he had cured his cancer by drinking rhino horn.
Yes.
Tincture.
Yes.
And then it just exploded for that reason, too. So you have multiple threats to the horn or rhinos, which is really a bad combination.
I mean, I got a whole, you know, this whole supply and demand chain thing. Yeah, there were like 22,000 white rhinos left.
Yeah.
And how could we possibly hope to meet the demand if we legalized the trade? I'm not sure if you're going to touch on trade at any stage.
I would love to talk about the whole legalization thing, because that was something I fought hard against when I was based over in Africa. But
absolutely.
We can, you know, I envisioned we would be talking mostly about the Black Mambas today, but there's so much to talk about.
This is such a great topic, actually, and it needs to be unpacked.
It does.
There's so many angles to this, and that just on that trade issue, the people mustn't forget that in the mid-90s, was it 96 or 98, when WWF convinced the Chinese Traditional Medicine Council to use the Saiga antelope horn as a substitute for rhino horn in a last-ditch attempt to save the rhinos from poaching in those days.
Mm.
Okay, and there were 2.5 million Saiga antelope on the Mongolian steppes, on the Russian steppes. And it was the New Science magazine. It's one of my favorite quotes. It's a frightening quote. the fastest extinction of a land mammal in the history of the world. Mm. Not even a meteor strike could cause the extinction of an animal as fast as the consumers did, wiping out that species. Okay, there's still relics or remnants of that species. There's all conservation projects running around. You guys are in Mongolia. Sorry, I'm looking at Katie sitting on my left-hand side. Nobody else can see that she's sitting here. But
yeah. I didn't introduce her yet. I was going to wait. She'll probably be on in a second. That. But yeah, Katie Shaw from The Living Desert is here, and that's where we're recording today at a fabulous zoo and garden out in Palm Desert, a place called Living Desert. They do amazing work out here. They have an amazing facility, and they've actually helped law enforcement in the past by taking seized animals, particularly reptiles.
And continue to do so.
Absolutely. So Katie's here. She's listening. We're going to get her on the show here in a few minutes.
Can you imagine if you think you can meet the demand?
Yeah.
And, you know, you want to stimulate the trade by legalizing, you know, the sale of stockpiles or 3D printed horns, and I've heard so many crackpot stories.
Yes.
You know, yep. And what have you. But imagine if, and as you said, it's a status symbol, so only the elite can actually afford it. Imagine if you have a population of 1.4 billion Chinese people, and 1% of them can afford it.
Yeah.
Now you make it available, so 5% can afford it.
Exactly.
My goodness.
Exactly.
Are we crazy?
Yeah,
it's a no-brainer.
And you're touching on two things that have always been really important to me. Like one, to me, it's the emerging, you know, affluence of China and Vietnam that are allowing this. And the populations there are so huge that even a small percentage of affluent or even just moderately
absolutely,
affluent people could be disastrous if they get onto a particular fad or trend, right?
Absolutely.
And then
It would be the extinction of the rhino.
Yeah.
You couldn't farm them fast enough.
No. And talking about the cap, you know, there was a movement. Namibia, South Africa were two countries in favor of legalizing the trade in, you know, harvested horn that was taken humanely off of live rhinos that were held in captivity and the sale of stockpiles. And to me, I'm sure you're going to agree with this, Craig. I am absolutely opposed to that because it is always cheaper to go poach an animal than it is to raise one.
100%.
Yeah.
And also remember that in traditional medicine, a farm-grown thing doesn't have as much voodoo as a wild thing that's dodged lions and, you know, the person that had to harvest it dodged poachers, anti-poaching teams, bullets in the army and what have you.
Right.
And, you know, we found towards the end when the stockpiles were leaking through. Remember when they started on the dehorning of rhinos?
Yep.
And then those huge hauls of 40-plus horns were being confiscated, being smuggled across borders.
Mm-hmm.
And our borders are porous. I mean, we're third world, you know. What do you expect? You know, and that was my other argument. Legalize anything you like as long as you can control it.
Uh-huh.
And there is no evidence to suggest that a country like South Africa has got any integrity at their borders. I'm sorry to say. You know, I mean, it just goes all the way up to the top. So now they're confiscating these massive hauls of horns that clearly come from dehorned rhinos somewhere. So the poachers were shooting the wild rhinos and then removing a tail or an ear or something to prove to the buyer that it's from a wild animal.
Interesting.
That the animal had to die for this horn to be produced, you know, sort of thing. So forget legalizing nonsense like that. It's not going to work. Why do we keep making the same mistakes?
Yeah. Plus these stockpiles have actually led to deaths. I believe it was the Limpopo Ranger Station was robbed around 2015-16 by some armed gunmen, just came in and killed all the rangers and stole every single elephant tusk and every single rhino horn that was in their stockpiles to sell. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, people, we haven't talked about this, Craig, the end sale point of a big rhino horn out in China or Vietnam is going for $100,000, $150,000 U.S., maybe more now, I don't know.
It's about 25 to 35,000 per kg now.
Per kg,
yeah.
So, you know, how much is average?
I mean, times that by 20, the exchange rate is now. You know,
it's a lot of money. It's kill you money.
For sure.
Yeah, it's
absolutely
the kind of money people will kill you for. And it happens all the time in Africa where people get killed over this stuff. And one last thing, you know, this whole issue on legalizing rhino horn trade for stockpiled rhino horn or captively harvested horn where it can be the rhinos anesthetized and the horns cut off because they do grow back because it's basically like a fingernail. CITES tried this Here's our first curse word of the day. Society's tried this bullshit.
We've been very good so far.
We have. We've been keeping it under control.
Yes, we have.
Craig and I are used to letting the F-bombs fly. But
my mother would be proud of it.
Yeah, you know, society's tried this before where they allowed a sell-off of stockpiled ivory. And all it did was create a market.
Oh, absolutely.
It created a market, and it allowed for the laundering of poached ivory.
Yes.
Because it's always cheaper to go kill an elephant
for
than
sure.
it is to
and deal with stockpiles. How are you supposed to tell the difference? And, you know, we got to remember that these are syndicates. So they're just going to syndicate it. You know, if they can buy up that stockpile, you know, there's probably enough diamonds in the world to give every woman a handful, you know. Mm. But we regulate we leak it onto the market to keep the price up.
Keep the price up.
And that's exactly what they do with the rhino horn. They would buy the stockpiles and they would regulate the price.
Yeah.
You know, so there's nothing good about legalizing the sale of any wildlife product unless you're the guy selling it, because you're the only one that's going to benefit.
Exactly. Yeah.
You saw the biggest advocate of this in South Africa,
John
Hume.
Yeah.
You know, with his 2,000 whatever rhinos.
Under arrest.
Guess where he is now, sitting in the chookie.
Exactly. Yeah, John Hume, if listeners don't know, he was the largest private owner of rhinos.
Yep.
Like, I think he had the largest private rhino herd. A very wealthy guy in South Africa for a long time. Mm. Everybody in law enforcement suspected him of being involved in selling his captive horns. He was investing a lot of money in trying to get the whole rhino horn trade legalized. Smelled bad. He was arrested recently by South African police, charged with trafficking in rhino horns. Mm-hmm. Surprise, surprise. No shock.
And you know what? It's not the first time. The little bugger just got off on the previous ones because of technicalities.
Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's another rhino horn farmer, too, we could talk about. But you know what?
That one's a little closer to home.
Yeah, yeah.
Right on my border.
I know. And I have a great story about that guy. He tried. Anyway, we won't get into it. He tried to meet with me once and convince me to advocate for him. And I smelled the rat on that one right away. Anyway, let's back up now. We've gotten a little bit off track, but I think it's a good discussion. But you mentioned, you know, where you were in 2010, 13 is losing three rhinos a day in Olifant. So that's unsustainable. One of the things, obviously, you're going to ramp up your law enforcement response, your patrols, your armed, all of that. But one of the things that you kind of hit on was this idea of forming the Black Mambas.
Mm.
What year did you form the Black Mambas?
It was 2013.
Yeah. So right. Things are going crazy with rhinos getting killed.
That's right.
Tell us about the Black Mambas. What makes the Black Mambas unique?
Oh, man. The Black Mambas was a concept that was born around that campfire where we stood up in my little camp on the hill.
Yeah, yeah.
And vast quantities of Captain Morgan as well, because he's like kind of the inspiration behind everything.
Craig, you're breaking the fundamental rule of what happens in the bush stays
in the bush. Right. but we recognize that using the old traditional techniques has never yielded the results.
Mm.
You know, you can't do away with it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what did we do whenever there was a crisis? We would go dust off our old army uniforms, take out our rusty old guns, paint our war paint on, and go chasing after the problem and try and shoot the problem away.
Mm.
You know, all we did was divide polarized communities.
Right.
There's the people in the park and there's the people in the communities. There's a massive fence now. There's more money spent on helicopter fuel. So it's almost like an arms race. You know? So we recognize that this was not appropriate. And I also believe that we were destabilizing communities.
You bet.
You know, yeah. Taking out the breadwinners, you know, either locking up the fathers or, sending them in a body bag somewhere else. Orphans, widows, it just gives the syndicates the upper hand. Mm-hmm. Now the people start hating you. It says, anyway, we wanted a different approach.
Mm.
And we wanted to build a different model, which included that tier right at the bottom that the British policing model has got, the bobbies on the beat.
Mm.
The unarmed, they're everywhere. They cover a lot of ground. It's eyes and ears. You know, everywhere you go, you see a bobby.
Mm.
And, you know, they're just well-spoken and they look good in their uniforms and tap you on the shoulder and ask you what you're doing here.
Mm.
You know, and you know, when they ran out of policemen per capita, whatever the ratio is, they put cardboard cutouts.
In the UK.
Yeah, in the supermarkets and what have you, because it still triggers that organ in your brain to say, heck, I was going to shoplift, but, you know, as a reminder that I probably shouldn't do that.
Interesting. Okay.
So we wanted to be visible. We wanted to saturate the landscape. We wanted to disrupt the landscape. And we wanted to make it unprofitable for poachers to poach. With a few that we had caught in the beginning. And there's another embarrassing thing, Ed, with everything. You met my dog in those days, the three-legged dog.
Oh, yeah.
He'd lost a dog in the line of duty, and
A
crocodile ended up eating him.
I don't think I needed to know that.
I'm actually wearing his collar as bracelets forever. And they asked me to take them off at the airport. I say, there's one thing you can never ask me. I will do everything else for you. You can even rubber glove me, you know, but I'm not taking these off.
Good for you.
Yeah. Anyway, we got Belgian Malinois, man, trained in Germany by the German police for purpose.
Hardcore.
We have FLIR night vision equipment. Mm. We have helicopters. We have special forces. Mm. You know, we have laser dot sights. We have everything. A poacher is a guy with a pair of flip-flops.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have a flashlight.
Right.
You know, he comes in with a rusty old gun with a compromised barrel because they weld an old shock absorber on the front as a silencer. So it compromises the sights. It compromises the accuracy. It compromises the velocity. You know, the whole weapon is compromised. He might have three or four rusty old bullets in his pocket that are green from the sweat on his hands. Mm. And he sneaks around in the landscape, shoots a rhino and goes out undetected. Mm. And with all the tricks in the book, we can't catch them.
Right.
You know? Right. So what the model had failed. Mm. You know, the old traditional policing model. Oh, you identify crime. Then you identify criminal. You pursue said criminal. Mm. Then you apprehend criminal. And you try and prosecute criminal. We failed on every one of those steps.
Interesting.
Lowest detection rate of crime, we might find a carcass 2 or 3 days later. We sometimes never found them.
Right.
Until the white bones are shining when you do your annual aerial census. Hmm. Yeah. To try and identify who done it, you know, three guys, one gun, who are you going to prosecute? We work on Roman Dutch law.
Right.
Mens rea, criminal intent, stop a vehicle that's got a rhino horn in the back. The guy says, hey, I was paid $50 to pick these guys up on the side of the road. I didn't ask what was in the bag. There's no criminal intent. Mm. It's so hard to get a prosecution. Mm. Why would you try? Mm. With such a low, if you worked out the amount of rhinos that died to the amount of prosecutions that we had, 56 rhinos had to die for a prosecution.
Wow.
And then the president has a birthday and he releases all the criminals for their birthday, his birthday present. You know, it's a stupid model. So why waste all the money on it? Mm. I don't say you shouldn't try.
I'm just
saying don't put all your hopes and dreams in that model.
You got to remember you're talking to a former federal agent. Yeah, I'm all about law enforcement.
So we want to do exactly. I know you'll understand this stuff, man. We wanted to displace the crime off rhinos and elephants and pangolins and whatever else. I mean, everything gets stolen in the bush, even wood, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So we wanted to displace the crime off the landscape, firstly, and secondly, onto a different commodity. Hmm. Cash in transit, vehicle theft, knocking off liquor stores, hijackings, and what have you, because the public prosecutors know how to deal with that shit.
Okay.
And, you know, and the police know how to get involved, and they've done it 100 times.
Right.
But if I phone a policeman in the middle of the night and I say, hey, man, I got a guy and I think he shot a rhino. 2 days later, my dog sniffs out an old rifle lying under a tree. And the next day, we find the rhino carcass. We try and get the ballistics matched up, you know. And then you stand in court like 5 years later.
Yeah.
You're standing in court and the defense attorney says, I've read in the newspapers here that you had 3.5 incursions a night. Mm. You know, this weapon was matched up to 3 or 4 different carcasses.
Yeah.
Is it not possible that another poaching group was on this landscape?
You bet.
You know, at the time, of course it is.
Reasonable doubt.
Absolutely. Yeah. No case.
Yeah.
So why bother?
Yeah, okay.
So we saturated the landscape. We disrupted the landscape. I can't remember what your question was.
Your long explanation is fine because it actually leads us right to why, what are the Black Mambas? Why are they so special, and why did you form them? I think we got to the why.
So
you're going to try to model the, you know, off the British Bobby system,
unarmed.
But eyes on the ground, kind of presence that deters.
That's right.
But what is it that's
proactive
unique stuff?
Yeah. So
Black Mambas.
We wanted women. It had to be women.
It's an all female anti-poaching unit.
First of its kind ever in the world.
Awesome.
And you should ask me why.
I'm about to. And the reason you have to ask why is because the answer is awesome and amazing.
And you know, my father's an old military man, and he thought I was starting a cult down in South Africa. He did. He was very dubious. A whole bunch of women in camouflage uniforms chanting and whatever.
Marching. Yeah. They're very disciplined.
They're very
extremely disciplined.
Goodness, you know, they took to the training like you've never seen. And I've trained a lot of people in my life. Mm. And the women took to the training with gusto, and I didn't have a single one fall off the training course.
No kidding.
If I recruited 20 finished.
Awesome.
It's incredible because they all help each other along.
Yeah.
You know, I'd catch them sneaking baked bean tins in their sleeves, you know, when they're marching, and I can see this big fat thing in the sleeve going up and down, you know. And so when you make them stand in the sun long enough for it to start getting hot, and then it burns, and then they want to roll their sleeves up, but they can't. And so it was great fun. Great fun training then.
Why all women?
Because, Ed, you know, we have to step out of the arena at some stage. Mm. Either because, you know, we're in our 50s now. You know, you look like you're in your 30s. I'm not sure. That's going to get me a free drink, I think, at the bar somewhere.
You're down for a free dinner on that one.
That'll be an hors d'oeuvre. But, you know, the reality is that we can't do this forever.
Yeah.
We have to pass on the torch.
Yep.
It's the local community's responsibility. It's theirs to cherish and nurture, and we need to instill environmental patriotism into them. Otherwise, it's just an arms race, bigger fences, more helicopter fuel every year to try and protect this for the rich white people that come down on safari. Mm. So why women is because with the investment I make into them today, I will get a multi-generational output. So it's like a Swiss bank account. You know, I take a young woman, she just finished high school, I train her up, I equip her, and I deploy her and give her all the resources, financial resources, whatever, to be the breadwinner in that house, to be the responsible person in that community. Suddenly she has the decision-making capacity to decide if she wants to have another child or not, or if she wants to build a new room on her house or send her kids to a proper school.
Mm.
You know, all those kind of decisions are hers to make.
Mm-hmm.
She's not sitting and the husband is the breadwinner and she's just collecting sticks and things, you know, for the fire. So, and imagine when she retires with me. So it's got to be a career choice.
Interesting.
I need to employ them, upskill them, and continue to find incentives for them to improve and climb the ladder, which is my biggest challenge, you know, because, I mean, we're 13 years down the drag, and they're very loyal to me, and I'm very loyal to them. And now, you know, you've got to keep finding ways to keep them engaged.
Sure.
And the secret is to make sure that once I've recruited somebody, that they will retire with me.
Interesting.
You know?
So it's like a professional option for them.
Yes, a full career choice.
And these are women from the local communities just outside
Olifants
West or any of the private reserves along that line. So they have influence in the community they live in.
Very much so.
Yeah. And now they're invested in the wildlife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, Ed, man, you know, the idea is they must have kids.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
because then that knowledge transfer happens, and then they will retire, and they will be sitting at home and looking after the children of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I get the bang for buck. So when, you know, that whole thing about planting a seed but never expecting to sit in the shade of the tree kind of thing? Have you heard that analogy?
Yeah.
You know, it's that.
Yeah.
You know, so I know I'm sitting here in the United States of America in the living desert.
Yeah.
And they're running the show.
Yeah.
They're putting their own patrol orders out there. They're running their own operations center. They're dividing their teams up to cover the threats and the risks and what have you. They do this SWOT analysis before they go out. It's fantastic. That is what empowerment is. Empowerment is not taking somebody, dressing them up, and then still telling them what to do every day.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, it's hard for me, and it'll be hard for you too, because we are from a top-down approach. You know, if I'm in charge, I'm telling you what to do. There's no ambiguity. This is not a bloody democracy. You know, especially when you're in law enforcement, you can't have a democratic process. It's got to be a chain of command. But I've had to learn, Katie knows, you know, she's been, there's the Katie, the secret Katie.
Katie's here.
You know, I've got a tactical Katie. You know how we've had to adjust everything from the training protocol, the recruitment protocol, to the training protocol, to the deployment protocol, the equipment that they need. Everything had to change to make this work. And it was so easy.
Okay.
Once we just go, we're so stuck in a rut.
Yeah,
you know, with how we train a ranger and deploy a ranger.
So they're unarmed. What are they trained to do? What's a black mamba?
Ninjas.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, they do have all that necessary training because it's actually it's unit standards. You have to.
Yeah.
You know, you can't be appointed as a private security officer or a game ranger, or what do they call it, a field ranger, unless you have done those training courses.
I see.
So they have that. I do not arm them for a number of reasons. And one of them is that I believe a weapon changes your mind. I carried a weapon for most of my career, for these 30 years. And I know psychologically that it does change. You know, you become a little braver.
Yeah.
And you take bigger risks. But the point is, these are mothers or future mothers. And they will be tucking their children into bed at night. And I want them to be telling stories, going to the community, sitting in the local Shabin, which is the local outdoor bars there. And I want them to be telling stories about the elephants drinking at the waterholes and the hyenas crying at night, you know, not, oh, and then I had my big old gun, you know, and then the double stack magazine with a 7.62 and blah, 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 you know, because that's the talk I hear around the campfire every bloody night with my armed response team, you know. And I think, imagine if that's all you've got to talk about, you know, we're not winning hearts and souls in the community with the velocity of a bloody 223.
Well, and then I think there's something to that you mentioned too. If a poacher encounters armed rangers, they may be more likely to use violence against the rangers preemptively, right?
100%.
So there's that too. But they're out there being essentially the eyes and ears. Why is that a deterrent to poachers versus the six guys with a gun?
I know, you know, I get criticized so much for our deployment policy because we've done the homework. We've actually published it in various journals as well, tested it and published it. Poachers, the information that they are buying from the insiders, the gate guards, the crooked rangers, whatever it is how to get in and out of the landscape undetected.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So
they don't want to be seen.
They do not want to be seen.
Yeah.
So that's the intel that they're buying. It's kind of useless to them if they're buying the location of a rhino 3 hours ago, you know?
Right.
What the fuck? I mean, that thing could be anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, they don't need that.
Yeah.
They know how rhinos work. They know fools.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's normally, poachers are normally in a group of three, as you know. Right. One of them is always somebody that's off duty, that should be working at a lodge, could be working at a lodge.
Right.
So they know the landscape. They know everything. What they don't know is where are the enforcement agents?
Right.
And they want to avoid them at all costs.
Right.
So if I saturate the landscape and it's visible, shiny badges on the side of the cars, flashing lights, you know. You know when you're driving down the highway and you see an official car, your heart rate goes up. You know, yeah. You quickly look around to see what your speed is. You stick on your safety belt. You know, you go through this mental thing.
Maybe you do, but I always follow the law.
I don't even have a seatbelt in my Land Rover, man.
I know you don't.
I don't even think the brakes work anymore.
I don't think they worked then either when I met you.
But that's the idea of visible policing.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody that's considering coming into poach or is insider is saying, no, don't bother. These guys, they're all over the place. Right. You know, they're sitting in all these hides on top of hills. You know, you can see their spotlights out every night. There's vehicles up and down. They're stopping every car and questioning them.
Right.
So it's a lot of proactive stuff. In between their patrols, they're knocking on doors.
Interesting. Okay.
Writing down who's staying where.
Ah.
Cell phone numbers. Can I have a look? Thank you very much. You know, looking in their bags. And
wow.
Yeah.
People that are inside the reserve. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So there's a lot of effort going into keeping, you know, the landscape clear.
Yeah.
But not a single shot has been fired in anger since I appointed them.
No kidding.
Mm.
At them or including your armed rangers?
Either way.
Oh. Wow.
It's like the landscape is saturated with these ondies.
Do you feel like it has actually helped reduce the amount of poaching you've got on the reserve?
I would like to say yes, but at the same time, I'm not stupid enough to take credit for that. Mm. You know, I think what really helped us a lot was the COVID-19.
Yeah.
You know, it stopped the supply and demand chain dead in its tracks. You know?
It made it very hard to move the horn,
yes,
right?
Yes, it did.
Because the... This happened. I was in Africa when COVID hit, and you know, unlike the United States, when Africa shut down, the military was all over the place on the roads. Police
That's
were
right.
on the roads.
Absolutely,
you could not drive without answering questions.
Yeah.
And so it became extremely risky to be moving contraband.
And also,
just moving around in general.
Yes, and all the insiders were sent home.
Yes, they weren't in the park anymore.
Wasn't a single useful person to a poacher, you know?
Right.
So the parks were ghost towns. I actually think that had the single biggest effect because, quite frankly, you know, in the rural areas where we are in the National Parks Network, a poacher could easily have got in and out because there was no other traffic on the roads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's the fact that they had nobody inside the park that they could phone and say, where are the anti-poaching guys tonight, Bob? Oh, damn, Bob's at home.
You know, I want to get back to the Mambas, but, you know, in this regard, with the corruption and everything, my big thing has always been, just because you're poor doesn't mean you break the law. Right?
Correct.
So
thank heavens.
Yeah, I know. So excusing lawbreaking because a person is poor, I don't buy it.
100%.
But the real insidious side of the whole rhino horn trafficking, pangolin trafficking, ivory trafficking is that local people who are poor are corrupted by those syndicates who come in from outside the communities, and they're offering a lot of money, and they corrupt people, and they also corrupt rangers who live in those communities, right? And those rangers face a lot of issues living in the same community where potentially bad guys live. Their personal safety could be at risk. They could be worried about their families, and maybe that's why they're corrupt, or they're corrupted by money. There are these outside influences from larger, well-funded criminal enterprises that corrupt these people. Why do you think the Black Mambas have been so resistant to corruption?
I like to say a lot of things about that, but it's a phenomenon, and I actually think it's cultural. Mm. You know, the other reason why we selected women, apart from the multi-generational return on investment, it's also because they're the primary caregivers in their community.
I see.
So, you know, and we must recognize that in the employment model. We must recognize that at least half of their responsibility is towards their kinship model and their pseudo kinship model in the community.
Right.
So the old grandpas and grannies and even the sick donkeys and what have you, and the young kids. If you go into any of these ladies' houses, there's like 100 kids running around, you know. And you say, wow, you've been busy. And they say, it's not mine. They say, well, I don't know. You know, they're just on the streets and they must get fed and bring them in, right. You know. And this is the neighbor's kids and that's the other auntie down the road, but she's sick and that one's at work and that's, you know, they're just carers.
Yeah.
They are phenomenal
nurturers
and resource managers because, you know, they're the ones that have to do the firewood collecting and getting the water in those big 20-liter cans on their heads and what have you, you know. So they don't want the water to be wasted and the firewood to be wasted because they just have to go out and do it again.
Right.
You know, and it's the men that are just coming in and burning all the wood and sitting around the fire all night drinking their beer and splashing the water all over the show and so on. So they will secretly have stashes and caches, and they have to think differently. It's a different set of neuro pathways. I know it's not answering your question, but I don't know why they have.
Yeah, but you're kind of implying that they might have a better sense of consequences.
Yes.
Thinking down the road, right? The short term on becoming corrupted and taking money to say where rhinos are is a short term gain, but it may harm me and my family and my community long term.
Absolutely. Let me tell you.
Which men don't normally.
That is right.
Men are notoriously not consequence thinkers.
You know, I want to collect sexy Land Rovers, you know, and, you know, I've got to put kids through school, but they can probably make it themselves, you know.
Let me tell you a story.
Yes. Is it a Land Rover story?
Sort of. I once traveled up to a small village. I can't remember the name of it, but it was in Mozambique, just across the border from South Africa.
Chokwe.
I don't think it was that one.
Masinjir.
Yes.
Yeah.
Masinjir.
Oh, my God. It's poaching.
Poacher haven, right?
Absolutely.
So Masinjir, it's right across the border, which means it's right across the border from Kruger National Park. One thing that really struck me, we're driving through town. First of all, we were told by the local magistrate in that town that we needed to be out of there by dark because it would not be safe for us. Yeah, because it had already gotten around that the U.S. government people were there, okay, looking into poaching. Anyway, so we're driving down the street, and I'm like, you're looking at house, little house after little house, and you're going along, and you're like, oh, wow, that's a rough house to live in. Ooh, there's another rough house. Ooh, those people are just barely making it. And then all of a sudden.
Suddenly.
Oh, huge, beautiful house with a beautiful Land Rover in it. And what really struck me is, that's a guy, clearly, who's involved in some criminal activity, probably rhino horn trafficking. and this bogus baloney that he is somehow benefiting his community.
Oh no, yeah.
Everybody else is living in dirt, and yeah. there's the single schoolyard in the town has no windows and no playground.
Yep.
It, yeah, it's a greed-based thing because he wants that new Land Rover.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it's a live for the day mentality. And you know
for the day mentality.
Yeah.
And that may be different from the Black Mambas.
But the women are
thinking longer term.
They are. And they
bigger picture.
It is one thing that they hold closer to their hearts than anything else in the world. It's their families, their kids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they think ahead for their kids. They want the very best for their kids. And that's why we make a huge mistake by excluding that value system out of you know, who is the most, I mean, those kids, I don't know how to say this, but the kids spend probably more than 75% of their time with the mother.
Yeah.
In those communities, if not 100% of their time with the mother or the grandmother, the woman, because the men are kind of, you know, rather conspicuous in their absence, you know,
right.
Like a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. The baby's yours. The pleasure's mine. Oh, goodbye.
Okay.
You know, and you can edit that out if you want to.
We're going
to
cut that.
You do that.
Okay. Katie's cracking up over here. Okay.
But it is a thing. So, you know, the moral compass of that child, you know, when that child grows up, the moral compass is coming from the mother or the grandmother or the sister in the house, not from the men because they're not around.
Mm.
So if I want to pass on the torch, and I want to have a community that fosters environmental I like to call it environmental patriotism, you know.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, it sounds cool. Yeah. You know, and it
implies ownership, right?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a national park.
Or investment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a private exclusive park. It's a national park. It belongs to the people.
Yep.
You know, so they must take responsibility. They must foster patriotism. Anyway, but you know, there's no doubt that women bring a set of values into the conservation arena. All the men in my 30 years that I've been there, we're interested in the helicopters and the 4x4s and the guns, and it's so cool, man, and the badges, and it really is freaking cool. And if I get a guy in that doesn't find that cool, he's in the wrong damn job. All right, because that's half of the reason why you should want to get it.
Mm.
The other half is because you want to save nature and shit. You know, but you can.
And,
you can do that by recycling too.
And on that point, there are plenty of good male rangers out
absolutely.
There and all of that. But the approach to the Black Mambas, I think, is really unique because you're capitalizing on that unique cultural position that women have in African cultures.
Yep.
And you're thinking beyond. You've got them out on patrol, and we're going to talk in a second about the things that they do, like their particular tasks. You've talked a little bit about it, but I want to go more. But there's a bigger picture to this. You're thinking Black Mambas. Okay, they're going to be those bobbies on the patrol. Their eyes and ears. They're reporting. They're being seen, which is a deterrent in and of itself. But they're also going back to their communities and advocating. They're educating. They're maybe even like shaming's not the right word, but maybe they're discouraging by, you know,
leading by example.
Yeah, leading by example and vocally chastising people who maybe don't do the right thing, right? Because that would be definitely a maternal job within the family structure. They're the ones that kind of lay down the law, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's a multifaceted approach to the Black Mambas have and a black multifaceted benefit that they have that's sometimes hard to measure.
Mm.
Right? Yeah.
What, it's hard to measure.
Yeah. So you kind of inherently know it's a good thing.
Yeah. You know, the anecdotes that I have.
Okay.
I mean, firstly, I haven't lost a rhino on my land. I touch wood now because it could happen whilst we're sitting here. You should never brag about something like that.
But when was the last time you lost a rhino on
it? It's been 10 years.
On Olifants West?
On Olifants West, where the Mamba started.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
How many? No, there are some there.
Oh.
We won't say how many.
We won't say how many, but yes, my land's going to be somewhat saturated.
Okay.
And we are on the strong public interface.
Yeah.
And we have a compromised landscape with mines and power lines. I make it sound very attractive, you know. But
it is. I've been to Olifants. It's cool.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's very cool.
But it's compromised compared to the other parks directly adjacent to me. And there's no fences between us, as you know.
Right.
You know, I should have lost all my rhinos by now. Knowing what I know and having managed all those other regions as the head warden of that whole section.
Right, of Balule.
Yeah. I should have lost all my rhinos by now.
Interesting.
And yet, I mean, you ask, what do the mambas do every day and night?
Yeah.
They're up and down the boundaries. They're shining spotlights in windows. They're watching every vehicle that comes along on the road.
Right.
Yeah. Sitting on all these high points with their spotlights and their night vision goggles. You know, if they find rhinos in a compromised spot, like too close to a road or whatever it might be, they babysit that thing until the sun comes up the next day. You know, they love that job, by the way.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
That's, I would love that
videos for me and they chat away merrily. It's great. We also don't sneak around. So I told them, this is a visible policing project. Yeah, and make noise.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because poachers are lazy.
Yeah.
If it's going to be risky or a lot of work, they're not going to do it.
But, you know, I think another one of the molds that we broke was we don't patrol in a stochastic regime.
What does that mean?
Randomly.
Ah.
You know, because you would assume that if you wanted to catch criminals, you must have a random patrol pattern and not have a routine patrol, because then they'll work out what your routine is and then they'll come in after your patrol's over.
Right.
We rather looked at optimum hunting times, because what is a poacher? It's a hunter.
Yeah.
Okay. When is it an optimum time to hunt, like a fisherman?
Full moons, stuff like that. Yeah.
And when the lodge vehicles are not on the landscape, you know, so on and so on. So we closed it, we packaged it and said, these are the optimum times that a poacher would be successful as a hunter.
Right.
We close those windows. Now if he comes in, so that's a routine. Every time we are closing those windows, every day, every night. So if he wants to come in and poach, he has to go in sub-optimum hunting time, which means he has to either use a torch or a flashlight, as you guys call it. Torch is like a old medieval
it's a
thing.
Flashlight. not the flaming torch, but a flashlight. Yeah,
exactly. March on the castle with your torch.
Yeah,
you know, so they'll have to use a torch, or otherwise they can't see a bloody thing. Yeah, they stumble around.
Craig, please speak English, okay? On this podcast, you need to speak English.
I'll speak English for you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Speak American English.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, then you must be my translator.
Don't say, if you say aluminium, we're done.
Aluminium.
Oh, my God. Okay, I'm sorry. I interrupted your old train of thought.
No, I'm on a rant. You know, so if you close those optimal hunting times, you force them into the suboptimal times, they have to expose themselves.
Risky.
You know, or very risky. And how do you deter a criminal? Make it risky.
Yeah, they're lazy.
Absolutely. And the landscape is not compromised, and they will go home empty-handed.
Yep.
And they'll do that once or twice and realize that this is an unprofitable pursuit.
Exactly.
So
I like it. I mean, some of the things I had written down here, you know, they do kind of classic foot patrols during the day, night vehicle patrols. You've mentioned that. Another thing that struck me, I looked at the website, you know, and I kind of forget about this because every ranger in Africa does this. And in the United States, we don't. Our park rangers just never deal with this. If they do, it's very rare. But snare sweeps.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Snaring is a real problem.
Oh, man, it's so bad.
Yeah.
This is the new thing for poaching is the freaking snares. And I know they're not new.
Yeah, but I mean, is it still mainly for bushmeat?
Yeah.
Yeah. And describe what snaring is, because Americans aren't going to really know what that is.
It's a piece of wire that they loop around and tie a slip knot on it. Right. And then they anchor it to a tree or a rock or whatever it might be. And then when an animal passes through, it's either going to catch you on the leg or around the neck or, you know, whatever it is. And the thinnest piece of wire will kill the biggest animal.
Yeah.
Just as to cut through an Achilles tendon or cut through a jugular or something, you know. Yeah. And it's a terrible, terrible way to go.
And normally they're targeting, you know, bushmeat animals like warthogs, impala, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
But I've seen an elephant with, you know, 2.5 feet of its trunk cut off from a snare that it got into. And lions can get into it.
For sure.
Even a rhino can get into it and injure themselves so badly that they
become. That's the thing. It's indiscriminate.
Yeah, it's indiscriminate. They die.
I actually refer to it as a wall of death, because they will block every path to a water hole with snares.
Yes.
It's like a gill net, you know.
Yeah.
And then if the landscape is too hot, I don't mean temperature-wise, I mean there's just too much activity, then they just abandon them.
Yeah, they never come back to check them.
Costs nothing.
Right.
You know, it's not like your rifle. You're going to go back to get your rifle.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but the snares, they just abandon them.
Yeah.
They can get that wire anywhere off your fence, you know. So then for years, that bloody wall of death is sitting there and catching everything from a scrub hare to a rhino, man. Mm-hmm. They're walking out with jewelry. I call it jewelry. Mm-hmm. You know, you see them wearing a bangle or wearing a necklace or what have you.
Mm.
That's our biggest coup with the mambas, by the way.
Yeah, they go out and look for snares and pull them out.
Their motto is find the snare before the animals do.
Yes.
You know, and they're bloody good at it. And, you know, it's like a treasure hunt for them.
Oh, it's hard. It's hard to spot a snare. Yeah.
I can't see them.
I can't either. Yeah. I'd go out on snares.
I'll get caught in them. You know, I have to call for help.
I can't tell you how many snares I walked past and the ranger behind me caught. And I'm like, what in the heck? How did you see
that? It's incredible.
Yeah.
But that's our biggest coup, because we've dropped the bushmeat poaching in our area by almost 90%.
Nice.
Yeah. In fact, I think the last animal I had in a snare was a young zebra, which was more than 400 days ago.
Hmm.
And yes, it was an everyday event.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I want to bring this. I think the black mambas are an amazing thing. What's your retention rate? You say you're 100%. Going 100%. You're going for people who retired. So the black mambas I met the first time I met you, which I think was 2015, they're still there.
They're all sergeants or master sergeants now. Yeah.
That is amazing.
They've done very well. You'll actually meet, you won't unfortunately, but when we go to Yellowstone, Wyoming, both of them that you will talk to met you the last time you were there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are going to interview one or both of the rangers that are traveling with you. They were going to be here today, but unfortunately, they got hung up. They're still they're on travel.
They're en route. They're en route now, I think.
Yeah. Okay, and that's going to be we're gonna dial in. Oh boy, Nkatika Mazimba.
Close.
Yeah,
Nkateko. Yeah.
Ha. Oh, there's an O. It's an O at the end. I didn't have my reading glasses.
There's so many consonants and very few vowels in that word.
Nkatiko.
Yeah.
Nkatiko Mazimba. Mm-hmm. And then who's the other ranger?
Colette Ngobeni.
Mm.
Both are sergeants, senior sergeants, actually.
And they remember me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
They remember Mike as well. They've got a really good memory. You know, if I see somebody on that landscape, here's the thing with doing the Bobby on the Beat style patrols, you know. I've been there 20 years, and then I see a car coming down the road, and I have to phone or call on the radio and say, who's that? And they'll say, no, that's Mrs. Jones. She's going to town. Every Monday she goes to town at this time to have tea with Mr. Jones or whatever, you know.
And you don't remember.
I don't have a cooking clue who that is. But that's why it's really important for them to build up that institutional knowledge of their beat. Imagine if I was switching around, and you know, a lot of other ranger stations will change around randomly so that the poachers don't get friendly with the rangers and vice versa, you know. But for me, it has to be consistent.
Yeah.
I need consistency.
The downside to that is you lose kind of an institutional knowledge of what's going on by the ranger, on behalf of the ranger.
Yes. Right?
Like the ranger knows that's Mrs. Jones versus. Yep. So they're not wasting their time on it.
I know.
Yeah.
But, you know, imagine if, because to, you know, Ed, our biggest problem with rhino poaching is corruption. You asked that question right in the beginning. Why did it start up again?
Mm.
You know, you've got to ask yourself another question. Why is it only in the Kruger National Park?
Well, is it though?
Well, there's no other national park that has been targeted.
What about what's the park over in Mozambique?
That's part of the Greater Kruger system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's open system.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So you're saying that the poaching's heavier in Kruger than it is
because of the corruption.
Yeah,
corruption. And it's an elephant in the room.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to talk about it. It makes me very unpopular, but somebody has to say it.
Mm.
The corruption is killing the wildlife. It's leaving our borders because of corrupt border control officials.
Mm.
It's being poached because of corrupt rangers and their senior managers. You know, the police are losing dockets or just not being interested. The whole thing is a bundle. We all know South Africa has got a problem with corruption.
Yes.
Right? We will win the corruption Olympics, and we will take the gold, silver, and bronze.
I don't know about that. There's some countries in Southern Africa that might give you a run for your money.
You're right, but even if we don't win the gold, silver, and bronze, we'll probably take them anyway.
You'll be okay. Oh, there you go. There you go. You will take them anyway, regardless of whether somebody beats you. Yeah, that's, you know, it's worth talking about because I was there for only, you've been there a long time, your whole life. I was only there for 5 years and I dealt with corruption every day. Mm. And I was a federal law enforcement officer from the United States and they knew I was a federal law enforcement from the United States and I still had to deal with it.
Yeah.
I had to, you know, when I was trying to collaborate with a law enforcement officer in South Africa or Mozambique or Botswana and Namibia are a little better, but you know, Zimbabwe,
oh, man,
you know,
it's a pandemic in sub-Saharan.
You always have to be aware that it could come into play. Right. And that's not something I was used to before I worked overseas.
And you know, but and there's a big difference between the private sector and the public sector.
Okay.
So my rangers, and I've got my armed response to back the mambas up. You know, I can't just leave them to the wolves.
No, that's why eyes and ears are there to call if they see something.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. But my investment goes into the mambas.
Yeah.
The armed guards. Yeah, exactly. You know, I've got a handful of armed guards now, where it used to be majority armed.
Interesting.
And one or two admin officers. You know, it's now the bar graph is totally different. But what I was going to tell you is that the integrity and the accountability in the private sector is 10 times higher than it is in the public sector because my members volunteer for polygraph tests every year.
Nice.
Yeah. They're doing them now.
Nice.
Actually, whilst I'm sitting here hiding because I'm scared I'll get caught.
You're just conveniently gone during lie detector week? Is that what I'm hearing?
Very conveniently. But don't worry, when I get back, I'll have to do it.
It's not, yeah.
It's
yeah.
But it's...
And
it's,
you have secrets that are not related to
that's
rhino
true.
Poaching.
Absolutely. Don't open that closet. All those skeletons that will come falling out.
And you pay that. I mean, the black mambas are paid, right?
Paid well, very well, because I want this to be a career choice.
Which brings me to, I think, tell us more about the Transfrontier Africa NGO and how do you raise money to pay your mambas?
Yeah, thanks, Ed, for asking that question. I dance under a street light in the little town of Hoedspruit. Mm. No, that's the Tortuga. It's hard. It's one of our toughest things is to raise the money for this because we made a deal with Olifants West many years ago when they appointed me as the warden there, 20 years ago, I made them a deal that I would take them away from trophy hunting because I believe trophy hunting is stimulating or muddying the waters with the local community as to what is right and what is wrong. You know?
Yep. How can a white guy come in and kill an elephant and I can't?
Exactly.
I get it.
You know, if I'm going to do this job, and I want to protect this wildlife from poaching, I have to stop the trophy hunting. Mm. And I must have a non-consumptive industry. So I have a tourism industry with 14 commercial lodges, very high-end commercial lodges, you know, like freaking 5 stars, 6 stars, that kind of thing on the landscape. That's what keeps the landscape going. But for the things like the black mambas, and you know, we've got the Bush Babies program, so the mambas are teaching in schools, and they've got 2,000 kids, 11 primary schools, full-time resource center, they've got scout troops running in the communities, anything to keep the kids engaged.
That's what you're calling the
knowledge.
Bush Baby program?
Yeah, we call that the Bush Babies, yeah.
Bush Baby's a little tiny, little cool little...
Absolutely, it's a little primate,
It's a little primate, yeah.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Cutest animal
cute, man.
In the world. We don't
Absolutely.
Want anybody to know how cute they are, because they'll start trafficking in them.
If they aren't already.
They're not ready. So, yeah. Okay, so the Bush Babies is kind of an offshoot of the black mambas, but it's focused on childhood education.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe Katie, you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
We'll get Katie on here.
That's
we'll get
why
her
we're
on
here,
here a second.
Actually, is because Katie does the, you know, anything you do in this world should be measured. Mm. You know, otherwise you can't change anything.
Yeah.
You know, how do you know if you're being effective by deploying the black mambas, for example?
Right.
I know because I track their performance and I will go out and let off a gunshot at nighttime and see how they respond. We will lay tracks down with a flip-flop on the end of a pole, you know, as we drive and wait for them to detect them and respond. So I know what their detection rates are. I know what their freaking reporting status is, whatever.
Beautiful.
Their response, everything. You have to measure. I even take snares that they've collected, put a little dot of nail varnish on it, and then I go and hide the snares all over the landscape again, like a poacher, you know. And then I can use a clever little statistical model to see what their rate of detection on snares is.
Look at you.
Which is why they go back 3 times to one place.
Uh-huh.
Because you're missing a lot.
Yeah.
You know, if they find one snare, you must know there's 3.
Yep.
Minimum.
Yep.
So anyway, anything you do, you have to be able to measure whether you're being successful or not. Mm. And it's the same with the Bush Babies program. Otherwise, I'm taking donor funding and I'm flinging it down a big hole while I'm entertaining a bunch of kids with soccer matches and puppet shows.
Right.
You know, am I changing perceptions? Am I changing value systems? Am I actually being effective in any way?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the partnership that we have with the Living Desert, where we're sitting now, and Katie, is so critical, because they have the skills. She's a scientist, and she comes out and she's developed this fantastic protocol, and she'll tell you all about it if you ask her nicely.
Yeah, let's bring Katie in real quick. Let me turn your mic on here, Katie. Give me a testing 1, 2, 3 here.
Testing 1, 2, 3?
Nope. Okay, so also with us, and we mentioned, is Katie Shaw from the Living Desert. She's a conservation social scientist out here. Welcome, Katie. Thanks for joining us at the last minute, and unexpectedly, you were not prepared for this, were you?
Not at all, but thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. No, it's great. It's a great addition. Tell me about, or tell us about the Living Desert. What is it? Like, I'm sure I didn't describe it right, but.
No, it's a zoo and botanical garden in Southern California, but we have a whole conservation department. So we do conservation off grounds at various sites around Southern California, and then with partners across Southern and Eastern Africa. And as Craig mentioned, a newer project in Mongolia.
Oh, cool. Boy, I'd love to talk to you about Mongolia sometime.
Yeah.
And all the species there. So how does the Living Desert get itself connected to transfrontier Africa and this crazy gentleman over here?
We've been partnered for, 8 years now, I believe. It's been quite a long partnership. We've done 2 social impact studies on the Black Mambas and Bush Babies programs in local communities. And then more recently, we did a, my colleague, Dr. James Danoffberg, and I did a social science workshop where we teach foundational social science skills and tools, and helped the Bush Babies educators create evaluations for their environmental education program. We wanted to make sure that we weren't just measuring if the kids were able to recite facts that they had picked up, but make sure they were having real impacts. Are they changing attitudes? Are they changing behavioral intentions? What are the actual impacts that this program is having?
Very cool. So, yeah. So you, Living Desert is able to help Craig kind of with some of the things he was talking about with measuring success and whether or not how things are working, right?
Yes.
What about financially? Is there any connection there? Do you assist with some of the?
Yep. Yeah, we're part of the Black Mamba Alliance, which is a network of largely zoos, but some other organizations that are regular funders of the Black Mambas and help provide salary funding for the Black Mambas.
Very, very cool. Okay. And how often have you been to Olifants?
I've been out there twice.
It's a cool place.
It's amazing.
Yeah, very cool. Great. Is there anything that you want people to know about the Living Desert, or how my listeners can, you know, visit here? It's Palm Desert, California, which is near Palm Springs, right? It's open to the public.
Yep. Come see us if you're in the area. We're a really neat place, have a fantastic habitats and animals here. And then again, do a lot of conservation work, and coming to visit us supports that and helps us support our other partners like Transfrontier Africa.
Fantastic. I think, you know, I want to raise something with both you guys real quick, and then we'll close it out. We'll actually close it out with both. We'll close it out with Craig, but give both of you a chance to talk about this. I want to know kind of from your perspective, what, you know, I have listeners all over the world, actually, a lot in Africa, but most of them are from the U.S. or North America anyway. What can an American do to help, you know, support conservation in Southern Africa or support the Black Mambas or what you guys are trying to do? I'll start with you, Katie.
Sure. I mean, of course, any financial support is a huge support. There's never-ending costs that come with running programs like the Black Mambas, all of the gear, the equipment, the patrol vehicles that they need, but also for the Bush Babies as well. But beyond that, spread the word, spread awareness, talk to your friends and family. Make sure you know what you're buying when you shop so you are not inadvertently supporting any illegal trafficking. Just become an informed citizen.
Yeah, awesome. Great. That's a great message. Craig, what are your thoughts on the same question?
Yeah, thanks, Ed. It's a question we get asked quite a lot. And I always say everybody has a responsibility to be a conservationist.
Mm.
And that means you must make a sacrifice of some sorts. You either sacrifice your time or you compromise your lifestyle or you donate something, okay, to whatever project it is that stimulates you. But we all have that obligation. We are users of this planet, occupants of this planet. So if somebody's living in the United States and you find the Black Mamba program, and we do live 100% off donations, we have no other source of income. So I would say reach out to, you can donate through our partners like the Living Desert, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been incredibly good to us. Rhino awesome. Mercy is another one. Okay. In fact, my directors are from the United States. Dr. Tom Tochterman is in Seattle.
Awesome.
Yeah, and he should be here, but he's not because he's having an operation. Huh. We've been friends for years. He was the guy that sat with me at the fire and drank all my rum and came up with the idea of the Black Mambas.
No,
together, both of us.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
Captain Morgan, so there were three of us. Yeah.
Very cool.
And he's a director of the company, so yeah.
So I want to tell a funny story. Not a funny story. Actually, it's not a funny story. It was a very important story to me in my career, and it relates to Africa. You know, when I was a special agent, I liaisoned with a lot of different law enforcement agencies all over the world and all over the United States. And one of the meetings I was at once, I was with a supervisory law enforcement officer from the state of New York. And he was in charge of their undercover unit or their special, you know, investigations unit. And at the time, their officers were going into downtown New York City and they were finding all these shops that were selling elephant ivory. And it's illegal to sell elephant ivory in the state of New York. So aside from what the federal law is, it's a violation of New York law to do that. So they were making these cases of elephant ivory in downtown New York City. And what was important to me about this story is I think it was a state legislator, you know, an elected lawmaker from the state of New York, or maybe it was somebody from the Wildlife Commission or somebody who was above this wildlife officer, really questioned him at a public meeting, like, why are our officers spending time on African elephant ivory? Why aren't you
wow.
out there? Yeah, why aren't you enforcing laws related to species that are native to New York? And this officer, he didn't miss a beat. He responded to that person who outranked him by quite a bit. He said this. He said, "Sir, in Africa, there are rangers in the field right now, you know, risking their lives to protect elephants and rhinos and pangolins and whatever. And there are rangers being killed every day in that pursuit. And I'll be damned if the people of New York are going to contribute to that."
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Give that man a beer.
Or how about a Captain Morgan?
Or a Bell's. No, but that's exactly the attitude we should be adopting.
Yeah. Think globally.
It's a global problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because we would want them to do the same, you know, if we had an issue with, you know, selling bald eagles in
Absolutely.
Pretoria, we would want some help, right?
Yeah, I know that gives me chills, actually.
Yeah, I mean, me too.
Good for that guy.
I'll tell you, I never forgot it because often we do get questioned about why does the United States care about rhinos? They don't live in the United States. Because.
Because you guys are the leaders of the first world anyway, you know, and you can't hold that position and try to influence global policy and what have you, and then turn a blind eye to that kind of stuff going on. You can't cherry pick.
And I'll tell you another story. When I was in Africa, if you're in a room of Africans and you say, "Hey, how many people have come to the United States?" Very few people will raise their hands. If you know, you might be the only one in the room. Not very many. if you say, how many people would like to come to the United States? Everybody.
Up, yeah.
And then I say, if you do come, would you like me to take you to Yellowstone National Park to see a grizzly bear in the wild? Mm. How many people would like to do that? Everybody, right?
Yeah.
Same is true if you were to talk to a group of Americans and say, have you ever been to Botswana or South Africa? Probably a few people would raise their hand. Would you like to go? Everybody would. While you're there, would you like to see a rhino in the wild? Everybody. So we protect these animals not only for our own citizens, but for people in other parts of the world, because we want them to come to our country and spend money to see these animals.
It meant we're a global community now.
I mean, it sounds like a baloney kind of kumbaya thing, but it's true.
But it is true.
It is true.
We are a part of a global community. We share resources. We sell things to each other. We have moral obligations. It doesn't have to even be a legal obligation.
No.
It's still a moral obligation.
And thinking like a black mamba, you're thinking 5-6 steps down the road.
Yes.
Of course, it benefits people of the United States to have wild rhinos, just as it benefits people in South Africa to have wild grizzly bears.
You know, the rangers, you touched on something that's very close to my heart. The rangers, they deal with the level one criminals every day.
Right.
They're not dealing with the syndicates, the mules, the couriers, whatever. They work under the worst possible conditions you can imagine, and all they can do is buy time.
Mm-hmm.
For the species that they're protecting.
Right.
The real changes are going to happen at the level that you are with U.S. Fisheries and Wildlife, at political intervention level, cross-border trade agreements and that sort of thing. The rangers, every day when they wake up, they're buying time for those animals. And the world's got to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do it like that forever. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Help them out. throw them a bone. You know
part.
What I mean? Yes.
And hey, maybe we should close it up with a African proverb that's actually listed on your website. And I heard many times, and you will have heard many times. But, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. And if you want to go far, go together. It applies 100%. All over the world. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, listen, Katie Shaw, thanks for joining us. Craig Spencer, I have been looking forward to this interview for so long. I am just so excited that we got to see each other again and have you on this show. It's going to be one of the most popular episodes, I think, so far. Thank you so much. If anybody is interested in learning more about the Living Desert or Transfrontier Africa, you can reach out to me through my website at naturesecretservice.com, and I'd be happy to put you in touch with Craig and or Katie. So we can do that easily. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Thank you very much, Ed. See you in the bush next time.
Yes, we'll see you in the bush soon, I hope.
I hope so, too.
Okay, take care, everybody. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.